I looked down at my hands, at the tile, at the toes of her shoes. A war. I didn't know. I was right. I was right, and you didn't listen. Again, she says, quiet. Her eyes lock on mine, and I find that I do not want the eye contact I craved, because it takes me apart, piece by piece. Uriah was standing right in front of one of the explosives they set off as diversions. He's unconscious, and they're not sure he'll wake up. It's strange how a word, a phrase, a sentence can feel like a blow to the head. What? All I can see is Uriah's face when he hit the net after the choosing ceremony. The giddy smile he wore as Zeke and I pulled him onto the platform next to the net. Or him sitting in the tattoo parlor, his ear taped forward so it wouldn't get in Tori's way as she drew a snake on his skin. Uriah might not wake up. Uriah gone forever? And I promised. I promised Zeke I would look after him. I promised. He's one of the last friends I have, she says, her voice breaking. I don't know if I'll ever be able to look at you the same way again. She walks away. I hear Shelley's muffled voice telling me to sit down, and I sink to my knees, letting my wrists rest on my legs. I struggle to find a way to escape this, the horror of what I've done. But there is no sophisticated logic that can liberate me. There is no way out. I put my face in my hands and try not to think. Try not to imagine anything at all. The overhead light in the interrogation room reflects a muddled circle in the center of the table. That is where I keep my eyes as I recite the story Nita gave me, the one that is so close to true I have no trouble telling it. When I'm finished, the man recording it taps out my last sentences on his screen, the glass lighting up with letters where his fingers touch it. Then the woman acting as David's proxy, Angela, says, "So you didn't know the reason Juanita asked you to disable the security system?" "No," I say, which is true. I didn't know the real reason. I only knew a lie. They put all the others under truth serum, but not me. The genetic anomaly that makes me aware during simulations also suggests I could be resistant to serums, so my truth serum testimony might not be reliable. As long as my story fits with the others, they will assume it's true. They don't know that a few hours ago all of us were inoculated against truth serum. Nita's informant among the GPs provided her with the inoculation serum months ago. "How, then, did she compel you to do it?" "We're friends," I say. "She is, was, one of the only friends I had here. She asked me to trust her, told me it was for a good reason, so I did it."
"And what do you think about the situation now?"
I finally look at her. I've never regretted something so much in my life. Angela's hard, bright eyes soften a little. She nods.
"Well, your story fits with what the others told us. Given your newness to this community, your ignorance of the master plan, and your genetic deficiency, we are inclined to be lenient. Your sentence is parole. You must work for the good of this community and stay on your best behavior for 1 year. You will not be allowed to enter any private laboratories or rooms. You will not leave the confines of this compound without permission. You will check in every month with a parole officer, who will be assigned to you at the conclusion of our proceedings. Do you understand these terms?"
With the words, genetic deficiency, lingering in my mind, I nod and say, "I do."
"Then we're finished here. You're free to go."
She stands, pushing her chair back. The recorder also stands and slips his screen into his bag. Angela touches the table so that I look up at her again.
"Don't be so hard on yourself," she says. "You're very young, you know."
I don't think my youth excuses it, but I accept her attempt at kindness without objection. "Can I ask what's going to happen to Nita?" I say. Angela presses her lips together.
Once she recovers from her substantial injuries, she will be transferred to our prison and will spend the duration of her life there, she says. She won't be executed? No. We don't believe in capital punishment for the genetically damaged. Angela moves toward the door. We can't have the same behavioral expectations for those with damaged genes as we do for those with pure genes, after all. With a sad smile, she leaves the room and doesn't close the door behind her. I stay in my seat for a few seconds, absorbing the sting of her words. I wanted to believe they were all wrong about me, that I was not limited by my genes, that I was no more damaged than any other person. But how can that be true when my actions landed Uriah in the hospital? When Triss can't even look me in the eye? When so many people died? I cover my face and grit my teeth as the tears fall, bearing the wave of despair like it is a fist striking me. By the time I get up to leave, the cuffs of my sleeves used to wipe my cheeks are damp, and my jaw aches.
Chapter 30. Triss. Have you been in yet? Kara stands beside me, her arms folded. Yesterday, Uriah was transferred from his secure room to a room with a viewing window. I suspect to keep us from asking to see him all the time. Christina sits by his bed now, grasping his limp hand. I thought he would have come apart like a rag doll with a pulled thread. But he doesn't look that different, except for some bandages and scrapes. I feel like he could wake up at any moment, smiling and wondering why we're all staring at him. I was in there last night, I say. It just didn't seem right to leave him alone. There is some evidence to suggest that, depending on the extent of his brain damage, he can on some level hear and feel us, says Kara. Though I was told his prognosis is not good. Sometimes I still want to smack her, as if I need to be reminded that Uriah is unlikely to recover. Yeah. After I left Uriah's side last night, I wandered the compound without any sense of direction. I should have been thinking of my friends, teetering between this world and whatever comes next, but instead, I thought of what I said to Tobias, and how I felt when I looked at him. Like something was breaking. I didn't tell him it was the end of our relationship. I meant to, but when I was looking at him, the words were impossible to say. I feel tears welling up again, as they have every hour or so since yesterday, and I push them away, swallow them down. So, you saved the Bureau, Kara says, turning to me. You seem to get involved in a lot of conflict. I suppose we should all be grateful that you are steady in a crisis. I didn't save the Bureau. I have no interest in saving the Bureau, I retort. I kept a weapon out of some dangerous hands, that's all. I wait a beat. Did you just compliment me? I am capable of recognizing another person's strengths, Kara replies, and she smiles. Additionally, I think our issues are now resolved. Both on a logical and an emotional level. She clears her throat a little, and I wonder if it's finally acknowledging that she has emotions that makes her uncomfortable, or something else. It sounds like you know something about the Bureau that has made you angry. I wonder if you could tell me what it is. Christina rests her head on the edge of Uriah's mattress, her slender body collapsing sideways. I say wryly, I wonder. We may never know. Hmm. The crease between Kara's eyebrows appears when she frowns, making her look so much like Will that I have to look away. Maybe I should say please? Fine. You know Janine's simulation serum? Well, it wasn't hers. I sigh. Come on, I'll show you. It'll be easier that way. It would be just as easy to tell her what I saw in that old storage room. Nestled deep in the Bureau laboratories. But the truth is, I just want to keep myself busy, so I don't think about Uriah or Tobias. It seems like we'll never reach the end of all these deceptions, Kara says as we walk toward the storage room. The factions, the video Edith Pryor left us, all lies, designed to make us behave a particular way. Is that what you really think about the factions? I say. I thought you loved being an erudite. I did. She scratches the back of her neck, leaving little red lines on her skin from her fingernails. But the Bureau made me feel like a fool for fighting for any of it, and for what the Allegiant stood for, and I don't like to feel foolish. So you don't think any of it was worthwhile? I say. Any of the Allegiant stuff. You do? It got us out, I say, and it got us to the truth, and it was better than the factionless commune Evelyn had in mind, where no one gets to choose anything at all. I suppose, she says. I just pride myself on being someone who can see through things, the faction system included. You know what the abnegation used to say about pride? Something unfavorable, I assume. I laugh. Obviously. They said it blinds people to the truth of what they are. We reach the door to the labs, and I knock a few times so Matthew will hear me and let us in. As I wait for him to open the door, Kara gives me a strange look. The old erudite writings said the same thing, more or less, she says. I never thought the erudite would say anything about pride, that they would even concern themselves with morality. It sounds like I was wrong. I want to ask her more, but then the door opens, and Matthew stands in the hallway, chewing on an apple core. Can you let me into the storage room? I say. I need to show Kara something. He bites off the end of the apple core and nods. Of course. I cringe, imagining the bitter taste of apple seeds, and follow him.
Chapter 31 Tobias. I can't go back to the staring eyes and unspoken questions of the dormitory. I know I shouldn't return to the scene of my great crime, even though it's not one of the secure areas I'm barred from entering, but I feel like I need to see what's happening inside the city. Like I need to remember that there is a world outside this one where I am not hated. I walk to the control room and sit in one of the chairs. Each screen in the grid above me shows a different part of the city. The Merciless Mart, the lobby of Erudite Headquarters, Millennium Park, the pavilion outside the Hancock Building. For a long time I watched the people milling around inside Erudite Headquarters, their arms covered in factionless armbands, weapons at their hips, exchanging quick conversation or handing off cans of food for dinner, an old factionless habit. Then I hear someone at the control room desk say, "There he is," to one of her co-workers, and I scan the screen to see what she's talking about. Then I see him, standing in front of the Hancock Building. Marcus, near the front doors, checking his watch. I get up and tap the screen with my index finger to turn on the sound. For a moment, only the rush of air comes through the speakers just below the screen. But then, footsteps. Johanna Reyes approaches my father. He stretches his hand out for her to shake, but she doesn't, and my father is left with his hand dangling in the air, a piece of bait she did not take. "I knew you stayed in the city," she says. "They're looking all over for you." A few of the people milling around the control room gather behind me to watch. I hardly notice them. I am watching my father's arm return to his side in a fist. "Have I done something to offend you?" Marcus says. "I contacted you because I thought you were a friend." "I thought you contacted me because you know I'm still the leader of the Allegiant and you want an ally," Johanna says, bending her neck so a lock of hair falls over her scarred eye. "And depending on what your aim is, I am still that, Marcus. But I think our friendship is over." Marcus's eyebrows pinch together. My father has the look of a man who used to be handsome, but as he has aged, his cheeks have become hollow. His features harsh and strict. His hair, cropped close to his skull in the abnegation style, does not help this impression. "I don't understand," Marcus says. "I spoke to some of my candor friends," Johanna says. "They told me what your boy said when he was under truth serum. That nasty rumor Janine Matthews spread about you and your son. It was true, wasn't it?" My face feels hot, and I shrink into myself, my shoulders curving in. Marcus is shaking his head, No. Tobias is. Johanna holds up a hand. She speaks with her eyes closed like she can't stand to look at him. Please. I have watched how your son behaves, how your wife behaves. I know what people who are stained with violence look like. She pushes her hair behind her ear. We recognize our own. You can't possibly believe, Marcus starts. He shakes his head. I'm a disciplinarian, yes, but I only wanted what was best.
A husband should not discipline his wife, Johanna says, not even in abnegation. And as for your son, well, let us say that I do believe it of you.
Johanna's fingers skip over the scar on her cheek. My heart overwhelms me with its rhythm. She knows. She knows. Not because she heard me confess to my shame in the Candor interrogation room, but because she knows. She has experienced it herself, I'm sure of it. I wonder who it was for her. Mother? Father? Someone else? Part of me always wondered what my father would do if directly confronted with the truth. I thought he might shift from self-effacing abnegation leader to the nightmare I knew at home, that he might lash out and reveal himself for who he is. It would be a satisfying reaction for me to see, but it is not his real reaction. He just stands there looking confused, and for a moment I wonder if he is confused, if in his sick heart he believes his own lies about disciplining me. The thought creates a storm inside me, a rumbling of thunder and a rush of wind.
Now that I've been honest, Johanna says, a little more calm now, you can tell me why you asked me to come here.
Marcus shifts to a new subject like the old one was never discussed. I see in him a man who divides himself into compartments and can switch between them on command. One of those compartments was reserved only for my mother and me. The bureau employees move the camera in closer so that the Hancock building is just a black backdrop behind Marcus and Johanna's torsos. I follow a girder diagonally across the screen so I don't have to look at him. Evelyn and the factionless are tyrants, Marcus says. The peace we experienced among the factions before Janine's first attack can be restored, I'm sure of it. And I want to try to restore it. I think this is something you want too.
It is, Johanna says. How do you think we should go about it?
This is the part you might not like, but I hope you will keep an open mind, Marcus says. Evelyn controls the city because she controls the weapons. If we take those weapons away, she won't have nearly as much power and she can be challenged. Johanna nods and scrapes her shoe against the pavement. I can only see the smooth side of her face from this angle, the limp but curled hair, the full mouth.
What would you like me to do? She says.
Let me join you in leading the Allegiant, he says. I was an abnegation leader. I was practically the leader of this entire city. People will rally behind me.
People have rallied already, Johanna points out, and not behind a person, but behind the desire to reinstate the factions. Who says I need you?
Not to diminish your accomplishments, but the Allegiant are still too insignificant to be any more than a small uprising, Marcus says. There are more factionless than any of us knew. You do need me. You know it. My father has a way of persuading people without charm that has always confused me. He states his opinions as if they're facts, and somehow his complete lack of doubt makes you believe him. That quality frightens me now because I know what he told me. That I was broken. That I was worthless. That I was nothing. How many of those things did he make me believe? I can see Johanna beginning to believe him, thinking of the small cluster of people she has gathered to the Allegiant cause, thinking of the group she sent outside the fence with Kara and never heard from again, thinking of how alone she is and how rich his history of leadership is. I want to scream at her through the screens not to trust him, to tell her that he only wants the factions back because he knows he can then take up his place as their leader again. But my voice can't reach her. Wouldn't be able to even if I was standing right next to her. Carefully, Johanna says to him,
Can you promise me that you will, whenever possible, Try to limit the destruction we will cause.
Marcus says, Of course. She nods again, but this time it looks like she's nodding to herself.
Sometimes we need to fight for peace,
she says, more to the pavement than to Marcus.
I think this is one of those times.
And I do think you would be useful for our people to rally behind. It's the beginning of the Allegiant Rebellion I've been expecting since I first heard the group had formed. Even though it has seemed inevitable to me since I saw how Evelyn chose to rule, I feel sick. It seems like the rebellions never stop, in the city, in the compound, anywhere. There are just breaths between them. And foolishly, we call those breaths peace. I move away from the screen, intending to leave the control room behind me to get some fresh air wherever I can. But as I walk away, I catch sight of another screen, showing a dark-haired woman pacing back and forth in an office in Erudite headquarters. Evelyn. Of course they keep footage of Evelyn on the most prominent screens in the control room. It only makes sense. Evelyn pushes her hands into her hair, clenching her fingers around the thick locks. She drops to a crouch, papers littering the floor all around her, and I think, she's crying. But I'm not sure why, since I don't see her shoulders shake. I hear, through the screen speakers, a knock on the office door. Evelyn straightens, pats her hair, wipes her face, and says,
Come in.
Therese comes in, her factionless armband askew.
Just got an update from the patrols. They say they haven't seen any sign of him.
Great, Evelyn shakes her head. I exile him and he stays inside the city. He must be doing this just to spite me.
Or he's joined the Allegiant and they're harboring him, Therese says, slinging her body across one of the office chairs. She twists paper into the floor with her boot soles.
Well, obviously. Evelyn puts her arm against the window and leans into it, looking out over the city and beyond it, the marsh.
Thank you for the update.
We'll find him, Therese says. He can't have gone far. I swear we'll find him.
I just want him to be gone, Evelyn says, her voice tight and small like a child's.
I wonder if she's still afraid of him, in the way that I'm still afraid of him, like a nightmare that keeps resurfacing during the day. I wonder how similar my mother and I are, deep down where it counts.
I know,
Therese says, and she leaves. I stand for a long time watching Evelyn stare out the window, her fingers twitching at her side. I feel like what I have become is halfway between my mother and my father, violent and impulsive, desperate and afraid. I feel like I have lost control of what I have become.
Chapter 32. Triss. David summons me to his office the next day, and I am afraid that he remembers how I used him as a shield when I was backing away from the weapons lab, how I pointed a gun at his head and said I didn't care if he lived or died. Zoe meets me in the hotel lobby and leads me through the main hallway and down another one, long and narrow, with windows on my right that show the small fleet of airplanes perched in rows on the concrete. Light snow touches the glass, an early taste of winter, and melts within seconds. I sneak looks at her as we walk, hoping to see what she is like when she doesn't think anyone is watching. But she seems just the same as always. Chipper. But businesslike. Like the attack never happened. He'll be in a wheelchair, she says when we reach the end of the narrow hallway. It's best not to make a big deal of it. He doesn't like to be pitied. I don't pity him. I struggle to keep the anger out of my voice. It would make her suspicious. He's not the first person to ever be hit with a bullet. I always forget that you have seen far more violence than we have, Zoe says, and she scans her card at the next security barrier we reach. I stare through the glass at the guards on the other side. They stand erect, their guns at their shoulders, facing forward. I get the sense they have to stand that way all day. I feel heavy and achy, like my muscles are communicating a deeper emotional pain. Uriah is still in a coma. I still can't look at Tobias when I see him in the dormitory, in the cafeteria, in the hallway, without seeing the exploded wall next to Uriah's head. I'm not sure when, or if, anything will ever get better. Not sure if these wounds are the kind that can heal. We walk past the guards, and the tile turns to wood beneath my feet. Small paintings with gilded frames line the walls, and just outside David's office is a pedestal with a bouquet of flowers on it. They are small touches, but the effect is that I feel like my clothes are smudged with dirt. Zoe knocks, and a voice within calls out, "Come in." She opens the door for me, but doesn't follow me in. David's office is spacious and warm, the walls lined with books where they are not lined with windows. On the left side is a desk with glass screens suspended above it, and on the right side is a small laboratory with wood furnishings instead of metal ones. David sits in a wheelchair, his legs covered in a stiff material, to keep the bones in place so they can heal, I assume. He looks pale and wan, but healthy enough. Though I know that he had something to do with the attack simulation, and with all those deaths, I find it difficult to pair those actions with the man I see in front of me. I wonder if this is how it is with all evil men. That to someone, they look just like good men, talk like good men, are just as likable as good men. Driss. He pushes himself toward me and presses one of my hands between his. I keep my hand firmly in his, though his skin feels dry as paper, and I am repulsed by him. "You are so very brave," he says, and then he releases my hand. "How are your injuries?" I shrug. "I've had worse. How are yours?" "It will take me some time to walk again, but they're confident that I will. Some of our people are developing sophisticated leg braces anyway, so I can be their first test case if I have to," he says, the corners of his eyes crinkling. "Could you push me behind the desk again? I am still having trouble steering." I do, guiding his stiff legs under the tabletop and letting the rest of him follow. When I'm sure he's positioned correctly, I sit in the chair across from him and try to smile. In order to find some way to avenge my parents, I need to keep his trust and his fondness for me intact, and I won't do that with a scowl. "I asked you to come here, mostly so that I could thank you," he says. "I can't think of many young people who would have come after me instead of running for cover, or who would have been able to save this compound the way you did." I think of pressing a gun to his head and threatening his life, and swallow hard. "You and the people you came with have been in a regrettable state of flux since your arrival," he says. "We aren't quite sure what to do with all of you, to be honest, and I'm sure you don't know what to do with yourselves, but I have thought of something I would like you to do. I am the official leader of this compound, but apart from that, we have a similar system of governance to the abnegation, so I am advised by a small group of counselors. I would like you to begin training for that position." My hands tighten around the armrests. "You see, we are going to need to make some changes around here, now that we have been attacked," he says. "We are going to have to take a stronger stand for our cause, and I think you know how to do that." I can't argue with that. "What?" I clear my throat. "What would training for that entail?"
"Attending our meetings, for one thing," he says, "and learning the ins and outs of our compound, how we function, from top to bottom, our history, our values, and so on. I can't allow you to be a part of the council in any official capacity at such a young age, and there is a track you must follow, assisting one of the current council members, but I am inviting you to travel down the road, if you would like to."
His eyes, not his voice, ask me the question. The counselors are probably the same people who authorized the attack simulation and ensured that it was passed on to Janine at the right time. And he wants me to sit among them, learn to become them. Even though I can taste bile in the back of my mouth, I have no trouble answering. "Of course," I say and smile. I would be honored. If someone offers you an opportunity to get closer to your enemy, you always take it. I know that without having learned it from anyone. He must believe my smile, because he grins. I thought you would say yes, he says. It's something I wanted your mother to do with me, before she volunteered to enter the city. But I think she had fallen in love with the place from afar and couldn't resist it. Fallen in love? With the city? I say. No accounting for taste, I suppose. It's just a joke, but my heart isn't in it. Still, David laughs, and I know I've said the right thing. You were close with my mother while she was here, I say. I've been reading her journal, but she's not very wordy. No, she wouldn't be, would she? Natalie was always very straightforward. Yes, we were close, your mother and I. His voice softens when he talks about her. He is no longer the toughened leader of this compound, but an old man, reflecting on some fonder past. The past that happened before he got her killed. We had a similar history. I was also plucked right out of the damaged world as a child. My parents were severely dysfunctional people, who were both taken to prison when I was young. Rather than succumbing to an adoption system overburdened with orphans, my siblings and I ran to the fringe, the same place where your mother also took refuge, years later. And only I came out of there alive. I don't know what to say to that. I don't know what to do with the sympathy growing within me, for a man I know has done terrible things. I just stare at my hands, and I imagine that my insides are liquid metal, hardening in the air, taking a shape they will never leave again. You'll have to go out there with our patrols tomorrow. You can see the fringe yourself, he says. It's something that's important for a future council member to see. I'd be very interested, I say. Lovely. Well, I hate to end our time together, but I have quite a bit of work to catch up on, he says. I'll have someone notify you about the patrols, and our first council meeting is on Friday at 10 in the morning. So I'll be seeing you soon. I feel frantic. I didn't ask him what I wanted to ask him. I don't think there was ever an opportunity. It's too late now anyway. I get up and move toward the doorway, but then he speaks again. Driss, I feel like I should be open with you, if we are to trust each other, he says. For the first time since I've met him, David looks almost afraid. His eyes are wide open, like a child's, but a moment later, the expression is gone. I may have been under the influence of a serum cocktail at the time, he says, but I know what you said to them to keep them from shooting at us. I know you told them you would kill me to protect what was in the weapons lab. My throat feels so tight I can hardly breathe. Don't be alarmed, he says. It's one of the reasons why I offered you this opportunity. Why? You demonstrated the quality I most need in my advisors, he says, which is the ability to make sacrifices for the greater good. If we are going to win this fight against genetic damage, if we are going to save the experiments from being shut down, we will need to make sacrifices. You understand that, don't you? I feel a flash of anger and force myself to nod. Nita already told us that the experiments were in danger of being disbanded, so I'm not surprised to hear it's true. But David's desperation to save his life's work doesn't excuse killing off a faction. My faction. For a moment, I stand with my hand on the doorknob, trying to gather myself together, and then I decide to take a risk. What would have happened if they had set off another explosion to get into the weapons lab? I say. Nita said it would trigger a backup security measure if they did, but it seemed like the most obvious solution to their problem, to me. A serum would have been released into the air, one that masks could not have protected against, because it is absorbed into the skin, says David. One that even the genetically pure cannot fight off. I don't know how Nita knows about it, since it's not supposed to be public knowledge, but I suppose we'll find out some other time. What does the serum do?
His smile turns into a grimace.
Let's just say, it's bad enough that Nita would rather be in prison for the rest of her life than come into contact with it.
He's right. He doesn't have to say anything more.
Chapter 33. Tobias. Look who it is, Peter says as I walk into the dormitory. The traitor. There are maps spread across his cot and the one next to his. They are white and pale blue and dull green, and they draw me to them by some strange magnetism. On each one, Peter has drawn a wobbly circle around our city, around Chicago. He's marking the limits of where he's been. I watch that circle shrink into each map until it's just a bright red dot like a drop of blood. And then I back away, afraid of what it means that I'm so small. If you think you're standing on some kind of moral high ground, you're wrong, I say to Peter. Why all the maps? I'm having trouble wrapping my head around it, the size of the world, he says. Some of the Bureau people have been helping me learn more about it. Planets and stars and bodies of water, things like that. He says it casually, but I know from the frantic scribbling on the maps that his interest isn't casual. It's obsessive. I was obsessive about my fears once, in the same way, always trying to make sense of them over and over again. Is it helping? I say. I realize that I've never had a conversation with Peter that didn't involve yelling at him. Not that he didn't deserve it, but I don't know anything about him. I barely remember his last name from the initiate roster. Hayes. Peter Hayes. Sort of. He picks up one of the bigger maps. It shows the entire globe, pressed flat like kneaded dough. I stare at it long enough to make sense of the shapes on it, the blue stretches of water and the multicolored pieces of land. On one of the pieces is a red dot. He points at it. That dot covers all the places we've ever been. You could cut that piece of land out of the ground and sink it into this ocean and no one would ever notice. I feel that fear again, the fear of my own size. Right. So? So? So everything I've ever worried about or said or done, how can it possibly matter? He shakes his head. It doesn't. Of course it does, I say. All that land is filled with people, every one of them different, and the things they do to each other matter. He shakes his head again, and I wonder, suddenly, if this is how he comforts himself, by convincing himself that the bad things he's done don't matter. I see how the mammoth planet that terrifies me seems like a haven to him, a place where he can disappear into its great space, never distinguishing himself and never being held responsible for his actions. He bends over to untie his shoes. So, have you been ostracized from your little crowd of devotees? No, I say automatically. Then I add, maybe. But they aren't my devotees. Please, they're like the cult of four. I can't help but laugh. Jealous? Wish you had a cult of psychopaths to call your very own? One of his eyebrows twitches up. If I was a psychopath, I would have killed you in your sleep by now. And added my eyeballs to your eyeball collection, no doubt. Peter laughs too, and I realize that I am exchanging jokes and conversation with the initiate who stabbed Edward in the eye and tried to kill my girlfriend, if she's still that. But then, he's also the Dauntless who helped us end the attack simulation and saved Triss from a horrible death. I am not sure which actions should weigh more heavily on my mind. Maybe I should forget them all. Let him begin again. Maybe you should join my little group of hated people, says Peter. So far, Caleb and I are the only members, but given how easy it is to get on that girl's bad side, I'm sure our numbers will grow. I stiffen. You're right. It is easy to get on her bad side. All you have to do is try to get her killed. My stomach clenches. I almost got her killed. If she had been standing closer to the explosion, she might be like Uriah, hooked up to tubes in the hospital, her mind quiet. No wonder she doesn't know if she wants to stay with me or not.
The ease of a moment ago is gone. I cannot forget what Peter did because he has not changed. He is still the same person who was willing to kill and maim and destroy to climb to the top of his initiate class. And I can't forget what I did either. I stand. Peter leans against the wall and laces his fingers over his stomach. I'm just saying, if she decides someone is worthless, everyone follows suit. That's a strange talent for someone who used to be just another boring stiff, isn't it? And maybe too much power for one person to have, right? Her talent isn't for controlling other people's opinions, I say. It's for usually being right about people. He closes his eyes. Whatever you say, Four. All my limbs feel brittle with tension. I leave the dormitory and the maps with their red circles, though I'm not sure where else to go. To me, Triss has always seemed magnetic in a way I could not describe and that she was not aware of. I have never feared or hated her for it the way Peter does, but then, I have always been in a position of strength myself, not threatened by her. Now that I've lost that position, I can feel the tug toward resentment, as strong and sure as a hand around my arm. I find myself in the atrium garden again, and this time light glows behind the windows. The flowers look beautiful and savage in the daylight, like vicious creatures suspended in time, motionless. Kara jogs into the atrium, her hair askew and floating over her forehead. There you are. It is frighteningly easy to lose people in this place. What is it? Well, are you all right, Four? I bite down on my lip so hard I feel a pinch. I'm fine. What is it? We're having a meeting and your presence is required. Who is we, exactly? GDs and GD sympathizers who don't want to let the Bureau get away with certain things, she says, and then she cocks her head to the side. But better planners than the last ones you fell in with. I wonder who told her. You know about the attack simulation? Better still, I recognized the simulation serum in the microscope when Triss showed it to me, Kara says. Yes, I know. I shake my head. Well, I'm not getting involved in this again. Don't be a fool, she says. The truth you heard is still true. These people are still responsible for the deaths of most of the abnegation, and the mental enslavement of the Dauntless, and the utter destruction of our way of life. And something has to be done about them. I'm not sure I want to be in the same room with Triss, knowing that we might be on the verge of ending. Like standing on the edge of a cliff. It's easier to pretend it's not happening when I'm not around her. But Kara says it so simply I have to agree with her. Yes, something has to be done. She takes my hand and leads me down the hotel hallway. I know she's right, but I'm uncertain, uneasy about participating in another attempt at resistance. Still, I am already moving toward it, part of me eager for a chance to move again, instead of standing frozen before the surveillance footage of our city as I have been. When she's sure I'm following her, she releases my hand and tucks her stray hair behind her ears. It's still strange not to see you in blue, I say. It's time to let all that go, I think, she answers. Even if I could go back, I wouldn't want to at this point. You don't miss the factions? I do, actually. She glances at me. Enough time has passed between Will's death and now that I no longer see him when I look at her. I just see Kara. I have known her far longer than I knew him. She has just a touch of his good-naturedness. Enough to make me feel like I can tease her without offending her. I thrived in Erudite. So many people devoted to discovery and innovation, it was lovely. But now that I know how large the world is, well, I suppose I have grown too large for my faction as a consequence. She frowns. I'm sorry, was that arrogant? Who cares? Some people do. It's nice to know you aren't one of them. I notice, because I can't help it, that some of the people we pass on the way to the meeting give me nasty looks or a wide berth. I have been hated and avoided before as the son of Evelyn Johnson, factionless tyrant, but it bothers me more now. Now that I know that I've done something to make myself worthy of that hatred. I have betrayed them all. Kara says, ignore them. They don't know what it is to make a difficult decision. You wouldn't have done it, I bet. That is only because I have been taught to be cautious when I don't know all the information. and you have been taught that risks can produce great rewards. She looks at me sideways. Or in this case, no rewards. She pauses at the door to the labs Matthew and his supervisor use and knocks. Matthew tugs it open and takes a bite out of the apple he's holding. We follow him into the room where I found out I was not divergent. Triss is there, standing beside Christina, who looks at me like I am something rotten that needs to be discarded. And in the corner by the door is Caleb, his face stained with bruises. I am about to ask what happened to him when I realize that Triss's knuckles are also discolored, and that she very intentionally isn't looking at him. Or at me.
I think that's everyone, Matthew says. Okay, so, Triss, I suck at this.
You do, actually, she says with a grin. I feel a flare of jealousy. She clears her throat. So, we know that these people are responsible for the attack on Abnegation, and that they can't be trusted to safeguard our city any longer. We know that we want to do something about it, and that the previous attempt to do something was...
Her eyes drift to mine, and her stare carves me into a smaller man.
Ill-advised, she finishes. We can do better. What do you propose?
Kara says.
All I know right now is that I want to expose them for what they are, Triss says. The entire compound can't possibly know what their leaders have done, and I think we should show them. Maybe then they'll elect new leaders, ones who won't treat the people inside the experiments as expendable. I thought maybe a widespread truth serum infection, so to speak.
I remember the weight of the truth serum filling me in all my empty places, lungs and belly and face. I remember how impossible it seemed to me that Triss had lifted that weight enough to lie.
Won't work, I say. They're GPs, remember?
GPs can resist truth serum.
That's not necessarily true,
Matthew says, pinching the string around his neck and then twisting it.
We don't see that many divergent resisting truth serum. Just Triss in recent memory. The capacity for serum resistance seems to be higher in some people than others. Take yourself, for example, Tobias.
Matthew shrugs.
Still, this is why I invited you, Caleb. You've worked on the serums before, you might know them as well as I do. Maybe we can develop a truth serum that is more difficult to resist.
I don't want to do that kind of work anymore, Caleb says.
Oh, shut,
starts Triss, but Matthew interrupts her.
Please, Caleb, he says.
Caleb and Triss exchange a look. The skin on his face and on her knuckles is nearly the same color, purple-blue-green, as if drawn with ink. This is what happens when siblings collide. They injure each other the same way. Caleb sinks back against the countertop edge, touching the back of his head to the metal cabinets.
Fine, Caleb says. As long as you promise not to use this against me, Beatrice. Why would I?
Triss says.
I can help, Kara says, lifting a hand. I've worked on serums too, as an erudite.
Great. Matthew claps his hands together. Meanwhile, Triss will be playing the spy.
What about me?
Christina says.
I was hoping you and Tobias could get in with Reggie, Triss says. David wouldn't tell me about the backup security measures at the weapons lab, but Nita can't have been the only one who knew about them.
You want me to get in with the guy who set off the explosives that put Uriah in a coma?
Christina says.
You don't have to be friends, Triss says. You just need to talk to him about what he knows. Tobias can help you.
I don't need four, I can do it myself, Christina says.
She shifts on the exam table, tearing the paper beneath her with her thigh, and gives me another sour look. I know it must be Uriah's blank face she sees when she looks at me. I feel like there is something stuck in my throat. You do need me, actually, because he already trusts me, I say. And those people are very secretive, which means this will require subtlety.
I can be subtle, Christina says.
No, you can't.
He's got a point,
Triss sings with a smile. Christina smacks her arm and Triss smacks her back.
It's all settled then, Matthew says. I think we should meet again after Triss has been to the council meeting, which is on Friday. Come here at 5.
He approaches Kara and Caleb and says something about chemical compounds I don't quite understand.
Christina walks out, bumping me with her shoulder as she leaves. Triss lifts her eyes to mine. We should talk, I say.
Fine,
she says, and I follow her into the hallway. We stand next to the door until everyone else leaves. Her shoulders are drawn in like she's trying to make herself even smaller, trying to evaporate on the spot. And we stand too far apart, the entire width of the hallway between us. I try to remember the last time I kissed her, and I can't. Finally, we're alone, and the hallway is quiet. My hands start to tingle and go numb the way they always do when I panic. Do you think you'll ever forgive me? I say. She shakes her head but says,
I don't know. I think that's what I need to figure out.
You know. You know I never wanted Uriah to get hurt, right? I look at the stitches crossing her forehead and I add, or you. I never wanted you to get hurt either. She's tapping her foot, her body shifting with the movement. She nods.
I know that.
I had to do something, I say. I had to.
A lot of people got hurt, she says, all because you dismissed what I said. Because, and this is the worst part, Tobias, because you thought I was being petty and jealous. Just some silly 16-year-old girl, right?
She shakes her head. I would never call you silly or petty, I say sternly. I thought your judgment was clouded, yes, but that's all.
That's enough.
Her fingers slide through her hair and wrap around it.
It's just the same thing all over again, isn't it? You don't respect me as much as you say you do. When it comes down to it, you still believe I can't think rationally.
That is not what's happening, I say hotly. I respect you more than anyone, but right now I'm wondering what bothers you more, that I made a stupid decision or that I didn't make your decision.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means, I say, that you may have said you just wanted us to be honest with each other, but I think you really wanted me to always agree with you.
I can't believe you would say that. You were wrong.
Yeah, I was wrong. I'm shouting now, and I don't know where the anger came from except that I can feel it swirling around inside me, violent and vicious and the strongest I have felt in days. I was wrong. I made a huge mistake. My best friend's brother is as good as dead, and now you're acting like a parent, punishing me for it because I didn't do as I was told. Well, you are not my parent, Triss, and you don't get to tell me what to do, what to choose.
Stop yelling at me,
she says quietly. And she finally looks at me. I used to see all kinds of things in her eyes. Love and longing and curiosity. But now all I see is anger.
Just stop.
Her quiet voice stalls the anger inside me, and I relax into the wall behind me, shoving my hands into my pockets. I didn't mean to yell at her. I didn't mean to get angry at all. I stare, shocked, as tears touch her cheeks. I haven't seen her cry in a long time. She sniffs and gulps, tries to sound normal, but she doesn't.
I just need some time, she says, choking on each word. Okay?
Okay, I say. She wipes her cheeks with her palms and walks down the hallway. I watch her blonde head until it disappears around the bend, and I feel bare, like there's nothing left to protect me against pain. Her absence stings worst of all.
Chapter 34. Triss. There she is, Amar says as I approach the group. Here. I'll get you your vest, Triss. My vest? As promised by David yesterday, I'm going to the Fringe this afternoon. I don't know what to expect, which usually makes me nervous, but I'm too worn out from the past few days to feel much of anything. Bulletproof vest. The Fringe is not all that safe, he says, and he reaches into a crate near the doors, sorting through a stack of thick black vests to find the right size. He emerges with one that still looks far too big for me. Sorry, not much variety here. This will work just fine. Arms up. He guides me into the vest and tightens the straps at my sides. I didn't know you would be here, I say. Well, what did you think I did at the Bureau? Just wandered around cracking jokes? He smiles. They found a good use for my dauntless expertise. I'm part of the security team. So is George. We usually just handle compound security. But anytime anyone wants to go to the fringe, I volunteer. Talking about me? George, who was standing in the group by the doors. Hi, Tris. I hope he's not saying anything bad. George puts his arm across Amara's shoulders, and they grin at each other. George looks better than the last time I saw him. But grief leaves its mark on his expression, taking the crinkles out of the corners of his eyes when he smiles, taking the dimple from his cheek. I was thinking we should give her a gun, Amar says. He glances at me. We don't normally give potential future council members weapons because they have no clue how to use them. But it's pretty clear that you do. It's really all right, I say. I don't need... No, you're probably a better shot than most of them, George says. We could use another Dauntless on board with us. Let me go get one. A few minutes later, I am armed and walking with Amar to the truck. He and I get in the far back, George and a woman named Anne get in the middle, and two older security officers named Jack and Violet get in the front. The back of the truck is covered with a hard black material. The back doors look opaque and black from the outside, but from the inside, they're transparent, so we can see where we're going. I am nestled between Amar and stacks of equipment that block our view of the front of the truck. George peers over the equipment and grins when the truck starts, but other than that, it's just Amar and me. I watch the compound disappear behind us. We drive through the gardens and outbuildings that surround it, and peeking out from behind the edge of the compound are the airplanes, white and stationary. We reach the fence, and the gates open for us. I hear Jack speaking to the soldier at the outer fence, telling him our plans and the contents of the vehicle, a series of words I don't understand, before we can be released into the wild. I ask, "What's the purpose of this patrol? Beyond showing me how things work, I mean." "We've always kept an eye on the fringe, which is the nearest genetically damaged area outside the compound. Mostly just research, studying how the genetically damaged behave," Amar says. "But after the attack, David and the council decided we needed more extensive surveillance set up there, so we can prevent an attack from happening again." We drive past the same kind of ruins I saw when we left the city, the buildings collapsing under their own weight, and the plants roaming wild over the land, breaking through concrete. I don't know Amar, and I don't exactly trust him, but I have to ask. "So, you believe it all? All the stuff about genetic damage being the cause of... this? All his old friends in the experiment were GDs. Can he possibly believe that they're damaged? That there's something wrong with them?" "You don't," Amar says. "The way I see it, the world has been around for a long, long time. Longer than we can imagine. And before the Purity War, no one had ever done this, right?" He waves his hand to indicate the world outside. "I don't know," I say. "I find it hard to believe that they didn't." "Such a grim view of human nature you have," he says. I don't respond. He continues. "Anyway, if something like that had happened in our history, the Bureau would know about it." That strikes me as naive. For someone who once lived in my city and saw, at least on the screens, how many secrets we kept from one another. Evelyn tried to control people by controlling weapons, but Janine was more ambitious. She knew that when you control information or manipulate it, you don't need force to keep people under your thumb. They stay there willingly. That is what the Bureau and the entire government probably is doing, conditioning people to be happy under its thumb. We ride in silence for a while, with just the sound of jiggling equipment and the engine to accompany us. At first I look at every building we pass, wondering what it once housed, and then they start to blend together for me. How many different kinds of ruin do you have to see before you resign yourself to calling it all ruin? "We're almost to the fringe," George calls from the middle of the truck. "We're going to stop here and advance on foot. Everyone take some equipment and set it up. except Amar, who should just look after Triss. Triss, you're welcome to get out and have a look, but stay with Amar. I feel like all my